everyone. I'm Bruno Huber, and this is Folly Bistro, which is a humorous account of the turmoils, fights, challenges, hopes, and ambitions of 2 years as the owner of a French restaurant in Vancouver's West End in British Columbia. It's supposed to be funny, and it is, in retrospect, for sure. It was outrageous. It's entertaining, and yes, it is all true. This story is a mandatory reading for anyone thinking of getting in and out of the restaurant business. And I mean it. If I would have known then what I know now, I would have taken a long, hard look at opening a French restaurant. I'll start with a disclaimer. All individuals are constructs of real people. All events are true. All opinions are mine unless otherwise stated. And all bills have been paid. That's it. So welcome to Folly Bistro and enjoy the ride. When I got into this venture of a French restaurant, I had no clue and relied completely on my partner Aldo, who had some restaurant experience. I learned pretty quickly, and I'll start off with one of those basic insights. The secret to a successful restaurant is really simple. You have to have bums in the seats. That's it. An empty restaurant is a black hole. A full restaurant might not make a lot of more money, but it turns over the food and money and looks busy, and busy places attract customers while the empty eatery remains vacant. I've often wondered why there will be a lineup at one place while the place next door looms empty, even if both sell the same food. Right across the street every day at lunchtime, I can observe this exact phenomenon between two Korean noodle joints. Ramen 1 is always full, while Ramen 2 remains mysteriously empty. Why? It's a crowd thing, I think. Elusive and not logical. Something to do with the herd mentality. It's not the food or the location. I tried both and could discern no difference, except one place was loud and full of energy, while the empty one felt depressed and as a result looked a bit dumpy. Rudy, our go-to guy for permits and inspectors and city halls and liquor boards, he suggested that we should put a banner outside proclaiming the bistro was under new management. How about under new Swiss-Pakistani management, Aldo chimed in, and we dropped the idea right there and then. I have sailed on the BC coast, tacking back and forth all day, never making any headway, but enjoying the fact that we were sailing. The restaurant felt a bit like that. Moving along all day long, but at the end of the day, we were no further ahead. The money that painstakingly comes in the front leaves out the back faster than it comes in. Whenever I think we're ahead, after a good night, I get an unexpected bill the next day that takes care of that. But I love our atmosphere. Warm, welcoming, even homey, some say, but classy at the same time. The mustard yellow walls and tablecloths, offset by the red bar counter and brass rails, the parquet floor and the authentic wooden bistro chairs, all based in diffused light from the low-hanging incandescent moon-like globes, which gave the place a cozy feel. A home away from home, it is to me, a place to relax and enjoy good food and company. That was the ambition, and that was the kind of restaurant I wanted the bistro to be, inclusive, not exclusive. We decided Wednesday night to be our 50% discount night. A ludicrous scheme we dreamed up to bring in customers on the slowest night of the week. Think about that. 50% off all entrees. Half price for steak or chicken. And it worked and brought in the crowds. This encounter of the pregnant kind happened on a very busy Wednesday night when we hosted the entire West End Seniors Association. Wednesday is our craziest night, even without special parties. But they'd reserved weeks ahead, and we felt obliged to honor the commitment. They booked for 15, and 25 of them showed up. Separate bills for everybody and musical chairs until they all knew where they were going to sit, across from whom, beside whom, and close to the bathroom, of course. At the same time, a skinny blonde woman with a pinched look on her face walked in and, without waiting to be seated, sat down at a table that was obviously already reserved. I politely tried to move her, but she refused to sit at the bar where we usually placed singles and early birds until their tables were ready. "I'm pregnant and I wouldn't be comfortable at the bar," she said with an annoying whine to her voice. She left me no choice but to believe her. We were here to serve, not to judge. So I let her have that table for two. I wanted Gina to look after her rather than Margot, who was busy with a table of six guys who couldn't tear their eyes off her. Gina took the anemic-looking pregnant woman under his wing. With her exasperating voice, she inquired about every dish. Did it contain alcohol? Was it organic? Had it been previously frozen? She eventually settled on a salad mesclun and poulet de Paris with no fries.
"I can't eat deep-fried foods," she whined.
She was well past her salad, which she demolished, and was lustily tucking into her chicken while reading the menu one more time, when she suddenly yelled and gasped as if about to die on the spot. Gina rushed over to see what the commotion was all about or if he would have to employ the Heimlich maneuver.
"Oh my God," she cried. "I need to call my doctor and my fiancé. You didn't tell me that there was alcohol in the salad."
"In the salad?" Gino asked, perplexed.
"Yes, yes. Here it says, Beaujolais poached pears, and I ate all of them."
"Well, yes, but there is at best just a hint of alcohol in the pears. It's mostly for flavor, and the alcohol has long evaporated." There was no way to placate the girl, and in his wisdom, Gino asked one of the West End seniors, women, to come over and talk some sense into the girl. After having listened to her tale of woe, the grizzled, stout senior, with her hands on her hip, told the girl to get a grip and a life. "You have to relax, girl. Get out and have some fun and stop this silly whining." Not at all the sensible approach Gino was hoping for. He quickly intervened and led the feisty senior back to her table, thanking her profusely, then ran back to the girl and assured her that no harm would possibly come to her from just the wine-soaked pears. It did no good. The girl was on her feet by now and, as if in a dream, steered for the door with outstretched arms and bulging eyes, gulping and crying, and conveniently forgot to pay the bill, stiffing us for the money and Gino for his tip. She was either genuinely messed up or just a very good actress, but either way, we lost. Well, the night was young yet, and we still had 24 owly and demanding seniors to please. When the old curmudgeons finally settled their bills, one by one, and left amid a flurry of mixed-up coats, hats, walking sticks, and purses, we were finally able to clear the tables for a second round of bargain-hunting diners, some of whom had been waiting patiently by the bar, nursing their drinks. Just one old biddy remained, steadfastly sitting at the head of the long table, apparently not in any hurry to leave. She was holding up the whole section. I walked up to her and politely inquired if she was waiting for somebody.
"I'm waiting for somebody to help me with my coat," she said with an air of exasperated finality.
"I'll help you," I offered, taking hold of her fluffy old faux tiger coat that matched her pillbox hat. She stood up and put her left arm into the sleeve and then stopped. I looked and noticed her right arm just dangling limply and thinly by her side. Shit, what now, I thought. Being a practical man, I gently took hold of her inert arm and quickly shoved it into the coat sleeve, which prompted her to turn around and whack me across the head with her good hand.
"Don't you touch me like that," she squealed.
"Whoa, hold it, girl," I replied, taking a step backwards. "You're quite the feisty tiger, Lily," I said from a safe distance. She cackled and then demanded, "Button me up, young man." I liked the young man bit, but declined her offer. Instead, I requested Margot's assistant for the delicate job. Now all buttoned up and coated, Tiger Lily was almost ready to move on. "Don't forget your suitcase," I said, trying to wheel her suitcase ahead of her out the door. "Don't touch that. Give it to me," she demanded indignantly. "Okay," I thought. "Have it your way." She grabbed the suitcase and wheeled it ahead of her with her good arm, pushing and leaning on it while she wheeled.
"It's my walker, silly boy," she said, with a twinkle in her eye. "And my name is Hazel."
I got it. A disguised walker. Very ingenious.
"What's in there, Hazel?"
"None of your beeswax, but I'll tell you anyways." She leaned close to me and whispered, "My survival gear, diapers, Kleenex, and toilet paper."
Over the 2 years, we went through 5 chefs, all of them artists, the minute we hired them. Yusuf was chef number 3, half Italian, half Egyptian, and needless to say, he had a bit of a temper and no lack of self-confidence. Yusuf, our new chef, had been absent for 4 days, sick apparently, which worried me. I had hurt my knee over the weekend playing soccer, and on the day he returned to work, fully restored to health, apparently, he wanted to know about my gimp knee. As soon as I mentioned soccer, he veered off on a tangent and proclaimed with absolute certainty that the Egyptian national team was the best in the world.
"The world?" I said, somebody taken aback. "What about Spain or Argentina?"
"Well, maybe not the world, but definitely Africa."
"You mean better than the Ivory Coast, better than Nigeria and South Africa?"
Yusuf gave me a withering look and didn't answer. "We're playing the Dutch next, and I already feel sorry for them. It's going to be a slaughter." I just sat there trying to digest this. Actually hadn't even heard or been aware that Egypt had a competitive squad. 5 of my closest relatives play international soccer," Yusuf said with his usual air of superiority. "One of my cousins plays for Manchester City. His name is Hassan."
I was impressed. "Wow," I said. "That's the big league."
"Yeah, he signed for 1.8 million quid, and ever since then, he's not answering my calls."
"Well, he's a minor deity now.
The punk isn't picking up the fucking call from his uncle, the guy who taught him everything."
I didn't know what to say.
"You know why I was sick the past few days?"
"What happened?" And I had been wondering how he could just get sick for 4 days when I don't ever remember being sick on the job, ever. Even now that I tore my ACL, I showed up for work.
"Well, after Wednesday night, which was super busy, I was hot and sweating, and I just came outside at the end of the rush and stood in the rain for about 5 minutes, cooling down."
This kind of behavior would never occur to a northerner, I thought. Typical hot-blooded southerner.
"The next day, I was sick with fever, and I stayed in bed for 36 hours without waking up."
"Unbelievable," I said. "36 hours? Wow. That's like a day and a half."
"Yep. When I woke up, I found out I missed the whole day, all 24 hours of it."
"Holy camole," I said. "And your wife just let you sleep?"
"She thought I was dead. If I wouldn't have been breathing, I could have been buried by now."
I let that one go. "Well, I hope you're feeling better, Yusuf. You know, you've been missed. We have the Christmas party starting and we need to do a lot of planning for the upcoming season."
"I'm 100% ready to rock." Without another word, he disappeared into the kitchen, yelling at his cooks to pull up their socks and work harder.
Sometime after Christmas, I noticed a new creature in the kitchen. A scrawny, furtive man who could be East Indian or Middle Eastern,
and seemed to be always in Yusuf's way, for the fact that the chef kept yelling at him, mostly in a foreign language. Once out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw Yusuf slapping him on the back of the head, but that might have been my imagination. "Who is that?" I asked Kena this morning. Kena is our most dependent employee from Sri Lanka. Short, 5'2" tall, with her big hair in a hairnet, she was our cleaner and prep cook, solid as a rock.
"So who is that?"
I asked.
"His name is Louis, and he is a friend of Yusuf's."
I noticed she hesitated on the friend part. "Well, what does Louis do, Kena? Is he working here?"
"Well, he helps Yusuf, fetches things for him, sometimes washes dishes."
I waited for my chance and caught Louis when he tried to weasel by me, head pulled in like a turtle. "Hi, Louis," I said, trying to be casual. "I'm the owner here, and I haven't met you yet." Louis's eyes darted around, and his head swiveled back and forth while he licked his lips with the pointy tip of his tongue. He seemed extremely nervous. He also smelled like a mixture of stale booze, old socks, and moldy cheese. He was dressed in ragged clothes, at least two sizes too big. He looked like a street person.
Hello, pleased to meet you. I'm a friend of Yusuf, only helping," he said in a hoarse voice with a thick accent.
"Okay, I must get your SIN number and address. How much did Yusuf tell you your wages would be?"
No need to pay me.
You pay Yusuf," Louis said, noticeably distressed. I shook my head, not knowing what to do. "Don't worry, I'll talk to Yusuf," I said.
"Please don't say bad things about me to Master Yusuf,"
Louis pleaded and scurried out the back door.
"Master Yusuf?"
I confronted Yusuf when he strode in the door, fashionably late for his shift, complaining about the traffic and the fact that people didn't move out of the way when he honked the horn. "Yusuf, we need to talk. Who is this Louis guy and what's going on? We can't have illegal immigrants working here. I hope you know that." Yusuf looked at me, then looked around, searching for Louis. "He left a few minutes ago," I said. "Well, Louis is a distant relative, and I'm taking care of him, teaching him how to work in a kitchen. You can pay him minimum wage, no need to pay taxes. Just give me his check, and we'll handle him."
"Yusuf, we can't do that, don't you know it? You act like he's your personal slave or what? Besides that, he looks and smells like he just crawled out of a dumpster."
"Well, his family owes me money, and he is working it off, doing the honorable thing," Yusuf said heartily. "And you should be happy to get cheap labor." "This isn't happening, Yusuf. You can't bring in some personal serf who is probably illegal, most likely drunk, and for all I can see, mentally unstable and definitely unhygienic. I will not have him back here." Yusuf turned his prominent nose up in disgust and disappeared into the sanctuary of his kitchen without another word. I only saw Louis a couple more times, lingering out back, waiting for his master to finish his shift, for all I knew. The whole sordid episode was incomprehensible to me, and there seemed to be no end to Yusuf's shenanigans. I want to read this little anecdote to highlight the plight of dealing with some customers. It's Sunday night, and since nobody wants to work Sundays, it's myself as the token adult and the ever-eager Mandy working the floor, with Alice hanging out with a faraway look in her eyes. Sundays can go either way, busy or nobody at all. We even tried magicians and musicians, and nothing really worked. A couple walked in and Mandy took them to table 12, an alcove by the window. They looked well-to-do, probably in their 60s, him in a fine tweed jacket with a silk tie, her in a bright red wool coat, a dark blue blouse, and a grey pleated skirt. The kind of customers we need, I thought to myself. Mandy spent an inordinate amount of time getting their orders and then went straight to the kitchen to confirm
who is Colin, our new chef. She returned to the table and I could hear Ray's voices even eclipsing one of Piaf's pained songs coming out of the bistro speakers. I started to wonder what was up, and when a distraught Mandy came to punch in the order, I casually inquired if everything was all right. He insists on steak tartare, but Colin said the meat was too old and he won't make it. I tried to explain to the customers and now they're pissed off. Oh boy, I said. I asked Colin if those were the facts. Yeah, this is Sunday and the meat is from Thursday. I don't want to risk it. Can't you just trim it on all sides? Colin shrugged his shoulders. You're the boss. I sauntered over to the stubborn customers, being all jovial and with my not worried and in charge face. How can I help you? I hear you were advised against the steak tartare. I've been coming to this restaurant for the last 30 years, he bellowed, his trimmed mustache quivering, lips compressed, nostrils flaring. And I always have the steak tartare. In fact, that's the reason why we're here. I was going to order a nice bottle of wine to go with it, but since you can't supply the food, we'll skip the wine as well. His companion said nothing, just kept poking at her piece of bread with the butter knife, eyes downcast. I'll tell you what, I said. You promise me two things, and I'll be happy to serve you steak tartare. Oh yeah? What's that? Promise me you won't get sick and you won't sue me. He looked at me taken aback. His purplish lips pursed, and there was a split second when I thought that I had overdone it. But then a big grin spread across the ruddy face, revealing a set of large yellow teeth, and he clapped the table with a guffaw. Well done, chap. You have my promise. We'll have two steak tartares on the double and a bottle of your finest Bordeaux. How about the Saint-Emilion? They ate steak tartare, followed by filet mignon, rare of course, and drank two bottles of the Chateau Rothschild. The bill came to $400. Mandy was ecstatic with the tip. Let's hope we don't get a call from a doctor or a lawyer. A promise is only as good as the one who makes it. In the last couple of days, we have also gained a new permanent resident on our bench on the alley side of the bistro. His name is Peter. He has a full beard, is the size of a grizzly bear, smells like a skunk because he cuddled and petted a run-over skunk the previous night until Gino told him to move the carcass to the other side of the street, away from the restaurant's front door. Peter beds himself down every night on the bench. He carries his old sleeping bag in a suitcase, has a small transistor radio, and even an alarm clock. He always shouts a belligerent hello when he sees me. I try to avoid him, but he is hard to ignore, practically at the front door. Shortly after we opened at 11 a.m., Peter walks into the restaurant without shoes, only his filthy woolen socks on his large feet. I can tolerate him sleeping on the bench, but now he has overstepped his welcome. You cannot come in here, Peter, I admonished him. Oh, just need some water, he pleaded. I filled up his old Pepsi bottle with water. Where are your shoes? I asked. Some bum stole them off me last night. I couldn't believe it. One bum steals from the other. I went into the staff room and retrieved some shoes left behind by one of our former cooks or chefs. Here you go, Peter, but you cannot come into the restaurant. Go up to the community center for your water, please. Peter thanked me profusely for the shoes and tried to give me a bear hug, which I firmly declined. He shuffled out to his bench and turned up his transistor radio to the classic rock station. Some days are just like that. Peter's residency became problematic when he started holding court with some of his cronies who came equipped with various forms of cheap booze. These gatherings started to impact our business as prospective customers opted for the other side of the street, avoiding passing by the group of smelly,
bearded merrymakers. I confronted Peter, telling him to take the party down the alley, away from the restaurant's front door. He assured me that he'd take care of it. "If they show up, I'll kill them all," he bellowed in his best operatic voice, which I'm sure could be heard blocks away. "Please, no killing, Peter. Just tell them to go somewhere else," I pleaded in a calm voice. I had visions of removing the bench, but that would cause more bleeding heart pushback from the odd customers and even some of the staff, who all thought it all quite novel and entertaining. The next day, a half a dozen of Peter's buddies gathered again around midday. Obviously, Peter's bench had become a regular jamboree. "Just call the cops," Gino advised me. "Or even better, call Aldo." I was reluctant to involve the authorities, and I knew that Aldo would make short shrift of Peter and his buddies without any consideration for the delicate social intricacies the situation entailed. Instead, I took it upon myself to reason one more time with wild man Peter. "Peter, you promised me just yesterday that this would not happen again. You leave me no choice," I said to him, while the group of guys immediately pocketed their bottles and moved off, not wanting any sort of public confrontation. Peter glared at me as if about to eat me for lunch and then broke into a wide grin, showing off his decaying teeth. "You call the cops? I call the newspapers. I'm sorry, Peter, but I'm trying to run a business here. It's nothing personal, you know that." "Okay, okay, that does it," Peter yelled indignant. "I'm moving out." "Peter, you're not moving out," I pointed out to him. "You're moving on. This is not your home. It's just a bench." The next day, first thing in the morning, "Look at this," Gina greeted me, stabbing the front page of the Vancouver Sun with his index finger. "Peter is a celebrity." My heart dropped into my stomach. And there he was, front page news. Peter getting a hug from the social worker, lamenting the lack of proper housing in the city, citing the poor and displaced like himself who are falling through the frayed and tattered safety net and are especially vulnerable at this time of year. Lucky for us, Peter didn't cite the bistro's bench as his last place of residence. In the photo, he still wore the old chef's shoes I gave him when another hobo stole his footwear while he was asleep on our bench. I breathed a sigh of relief and silently wished him good luck. That's it, folks. I left out a lot, but I hope you got a taste of what this book is all about. Despite all the craziness, I had a lot of fun running Folly Bistro. And people ask me all the time if I made any money, and that's when I tell the little joke of how to make a million in a restaurant. You start with 2 million. Now I hope you go out and buy the book. It's available on Amazon. Just type in Folly Bistro, and my name is Bruno Huber. Thank you very much for listening.